Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. As federal funding for immigration enforcement increases, immigrant communities across the country, including right here in the Bay Area, are facing new levels of fear and uncertainty. In Marin County, Canal Alliance works directly with Latino immigrant families, offering legal, social, and educational support. We wanted to understand, what does this moment feel like for the people Canal Alliance serves? Joining us now is Omar Carrera, CEO of that organization, and we're so happy to have him. Omar, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, our pleasure. So, Omar, tell me, what are you hearing from the immigrant families in the community that you serve? Is this a time of heightened fear or uncertainty?
Yes, I mean, we are seeing every day many immigrant families are feeling a lot of anxiety right now. I mean, just simply hearing about the possibility of an ICE activity, even if it's just a rumor, is causing a lot of panic and disruption in their lives.
You know, your organization, Canal Alliance, is based in San Rafael. And for listeners who may not be familiar with the immigrant community in your area, can you tell us a little bit about who it is comprised of and who you serve?
Yeah, the Latino community represent at the county level around 19%. And in the city of San Rafael, they represent 30% of the population. Most of the Latino families in the area of San Rafael are coming from Central America, Guatemala being the number one country. But we have a lot of families that have mixed status. So what we see in the news sometimes is the crisis in the southern border create this perception that everyone in our community is undocumented, and that's not the case. The main trigger of the Latino growth in this area has been birth, not migration. And that's why we have a lot of families with mixed status.
And when you say mixed status, what do you mean?
I mean, potentially parents, they're undocumented, and U.S. citizen children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it is a very difficult time for the community and the allies around it. Have you seen an increase in ICE activity or immigration enforcement here in the Bay Area in recent months?
I mean, we have seen at the courts a lot of presence from ICE. But we also just learning a lot from our friends in Southern California, you know, why they prioritize LA and that community. And what we are learning is they went for the big concentration of the Latino families in that area, making it easier in terms of logistically speaking for ICE to do what they're doing. So I think in San Francisco and other Bay Area, or big cities in the Bay Area, they didn't have that big a concentration. And I think just giving it time for the federal government to get organized, secure the funding, and be able to enhance the logistical support that they need to move into this, to Northern California. So we are preparing for that. Unfortunately, we're gonna be seeing ICE raids in our communities, and we are trying to do the best we can to be ready for that.
You know, we've seen on the news that ICE has shown up to courts where people are trying to confirm their legal status or get more information about what they can and should be doing to remain in this country. And, you know, ICE is targeting those kind of public spaces. Are your clients staying away from places like clinics or schools or government offices out of fear of being caught up in an ICE dragnet?
We have seen already the symptoms of fear, right? It's forcing people to stay in the shadows, avoid going to doctor's appointments or taking children to school. That will continue to grow as ICE continue to practice, you know, showing up to communities, even without uniforms or warrants, you know, claiming to be law enforcement. This creates significant confusion and fear, particularly because there is no due process of clear respect of legal rights. So we are already seeing the decline in participation in community events. And this is unfortunately just the beginning of that.
Mm-hmm. When you say that there's no due process, kind of unpack that for us. What do you mean by that?
I mean, every single individual in this country has constitutional rights. And those constitutional rights are being ignored by law enforcement, you know, even ignoring then the fact that they might have a status right now. They don't care. They don't care that they might be not speaking in front of the lawyer. So I do think that this is creating a lot of harm and mistrust in the system, and it's going to create more problems for all of us.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so troubling to hear that people aren't getting the services, you know, not only that they are entitled to, but they deserve, you know, the idea that children might not go to school or somebody might not get medical care because they are afraid. How does your organization address that and kind of bridge that gap?
I mean, we have been doing the best we can to provide education and enhance capacity to provide immigration legal services, right? Having access right now to immigration legal services through an attorney is crucial. And we have been focusing our efforts on that. But we know that this problem is bigger than our own capacity. So we have been engaging a cross-institutional coalition to recognize ICE raids as a scale impact scenario and not just an immigration policy issue. This is about emergency preparedness, continuity operations for businesses that rely heavily on the workforce, and protecting our community in general. Mm. So we have been working with the city and county and using the emergency management system to do a scenario planning and identify what are the support services, the families that are going to be impacted by ICE raids are going to need to respond to that. And also, what can we do to be prepared for it?
Well, I can imagine a scenario in which possibly, you know, parents are detained by ICE, leaving children without parents. I mean, that's a hypothetical. Have you seen anything like that or heard about anything like that so far?
Well, for us, it's not hypothetical. We witnessed that in 2007 when ICE went to Bella Vista Elementary School to detain the families or parents after they drop off to the kids in the school. So when they left the school and they couldn't see the parents, you know, so we already have seen this happening in our community. And that's what we are trying to do the best we can to prepare. The canal neighborhood is a very, you know, we don't have too many access to freeways. So it's very easy to target that community. And that's what for us, our focus is on activating everyone and every single institution to support that. Because while the immigration, the ICE raid will impact directly the immigrant community or the Latino community in this case, very quickly it's going to move to other aspects of our lives and other institutions. So all of us need to work together in this.
When you say that all of us, I mean, obviously we need to work together, but what's the worst case scenario that you're thinking about? I mean, today they're focused on, you know, alleged immigration enforcement. What are you kind of hinting at here when you say that this could become bigger or affect more people?
Yeah, I mean, ICE raids or ICE operations in general, they produce community-wide ripple effects, right? Including public safety risk. You know, people are not going to be trusting on law enforcement, and that has an impact on the local police and their work. It has public health impacts, you know, psychological trauma, stress. People might choose not to go to community clinics or to see help. We have social disruptions, you know, family separation, leaving children alone and creating social welfare emergencies. We have already school systems, they are facing absenteeism and emotional trauma among students. It will be an economic shock because immigrants play a crucial role in a local economy. You know, they are contributing to our system in a ways that we don't talk enough about it. So it's going to be businesses impacted by that. Mm-hmm. And really just the erosion of trust in our society that is very risky to lose that. And that's what keeps us together. So it has multiple impacts across all our aspects of life.
Yeah, so true. I mean, well, as we sit here, Omar, what is the kind of support that your organization or families need most right now? Is it legal services, emotional support, financial help, something else?
I think really helping organizations like Canal Alliance to increase capacity on immigration legal services, that is the short-term need, because we need to make sure that everybody has access to legal counsel and support. And right behind that, we need to start investing in infrastructure that's going to help us respond to the impact of massive ICE raids in our communities. So that's next for us. You know, we are building a rapid response network with other partners in the county, and we are mobilizing the philanthropic community to be part of the solution. As federal funding gets disrupted or eliminated, we are looking at our local government or local philanthropists in our state to step up. This is the time to do that.
If people witness an ICE raid or are bystanders at that, do you or your organization have any recommended ways to respond to that?
You know, we used to definitely encourage people to document actions that could potentially serve to the person that's being impacted by that detention. Right now, we are recommending the same, but really acknowledging the risk of that we have seen and witnessed how low ICE is responding to that. So I do think that still recording activities, documenting will help in the long run. So my recommendation is please do it, but also protect yourself because you also are at risk.
Yeah. We have a listener question from Rick. He asks, you know, basically, is the fear so extreme that some families are moving out of the country? In other words, self-deporting. Is that something that's happening in the community?
I think we have heard cases of that already in farming areas, right? With they had decided just to leave and go back to their home countries, and those businesses are already being affected by. And eventually, all of us will be, right?
Right, right.
Food security will be an issue in the coming months and years.
Well, you know, as we wrap this segment up, I mean, it's hard to find quote unquote hope in a time like this. But are there moments of solidarity or, you know, resistance that you've seen in the community and the larger community that have shored you up? Because I'm sure it must be a difficult time for you, Omar.
Yes, it's a difficult time for all of us, definitely for the ones who are in the front lines. We are feeling it every single day. But we have seen also a lot of solidarity, support coming from our communities. I think we do, in the Bay Area at least, we do understand that this is about more than immigration. This is about who we are as a region, as a society. And we're going to uphold our values, you know, equity, humanity, and justice for all is something that the Bay Area has been always leading in. And I think this is a time we're going to show that.
Well, Omar, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and helping us understand what this moment feels like for so many families in our region. That was Omar Carrera. He's the CEO of Canal Alliance, a nonprofit based in San Rafael that supports Latino immigrants in Marin. Thanks again, Omar.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Canal Alliance on the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. Coming up next, we're delving into the emotional roots of America's political divide. Stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. The WNBA is having labor struggles, but players are cashing in off the court.
The number one people that are willing to spend money are the brands. The brands have this job of pushing this forth and really pushing the consumerism tied to these players.
How WNBA players are shaping consumer culture. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs.
Philosophy Talk is the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
But you know who is questioning your intelligence? The powers that be, that's who.
First they cut the National Endowment for the Humanities, and now support for public media. That's most of the funding we depend on.
KALW is the station that first put us on the air. So if Philosophy Talk matters to you, please help right now.
Make a donation at kalw.org. And if you can, make it monthly.
Stand with KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Arlie Hochschild is one of the Bay Area's most respected sociologists. And in her new book, Stolen Pride, she takes us deep into the emotional lives of conservative Americans who feel left behind by cultural change. But the story she tells us isn't just about Kentucky or Appalachia. It has something to say to all of us, even here in the Bay Area. Today, we talk to Hochschild about what happens when people feel their dignity has been lost and how we might begin to rebuild understanding across the country's growing divide. Arlie Hochschild, welcome to State of the Bay. We're so glad to have you with
us. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. And before we begin, listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you think that Bay Area progressives are doing enough to understand the rest of the country, or are we stuck in our own bubble? Get in touch with us by email at stateofthebay@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255, or you can find us on social media. So, Arlie, let's start with the book. And I wanted to ask you about the title, which is Stolen Pride. What do you mean by that?
It's a funny title. You don't think someone can steal your pride. You have your pride. How could someone take it away? Well, this story that I tell in Stolen Pride is of the whitest and second poorest congressional district in the country, Kentucky 5, Eastern Kentucky. Coal jobs went out, opiate crisis came in, and then Donald Trump is offering, I think, a devastating kind of solutions to real problems. And so you have a story of loss. And these are very proud people, and who often said, you know, coal kept electricity on, won World War I, World War II, we're proud of that. That's lost. Mm. So you have a story of loss. And then you have shame. People feel that they're individually responsible for their fate and, you know, the American dream, kind of the Protestant ethic, you should get there yourself. And if you've lost your job, you feel like you've failed. Mm. So there's kind of a shame. And then you have someone like Donald Trump who comes in and says, oh, your pride isn't just lost, it's been stolen. Mm. Stolen by whom? Well, stolen by, you know, the terrible press, the left, you know, Democrats, immigrants, these are thieves, and I will give it back to you. I will restore your pride and take revenge. That is the stolen pride narrative. And I think it plays on real feelings and takes us into the emergency we now face in this country.
Well, this is you since the election of Donald Trump and a little bit before that, too. I mean, you have been working to understand this, to understand the feelings of people who have supported the rise, and not just the right, but what we would maybe say Donald Trump's version or Trumpism. And your goal, you've said, because you come from this as a sociologist, is to kind of cross this empathy wall. And in doing so, how are you able to do that? Because this, I mean, this is well, deeply reported work that you've done.
Well, you know, what I do is take my moral and political alarm system off temporarily. I put it right back on later. But I try and answer a genuine curiosity that I have and that I invite all of us to have about what's going on. And that is why I've gone to this MAGA base where, in fact, these were once FDR Democrats and Bill Clinton Democrats, but for the last three elections have gone 80% for Donald Trump. So we all need to cross the empathy wall. We all can do it, but it takes wanting to for the first and able to empathize with people that really you have profound basic differences with. So that's what I think it takes. But you know, once you do, you begin to hear rhetoric in a different way. And here's what I mean. A lot of people I've talked to in Berkeley says, "Oh, this idiot, Donald Trump, he's ranting. You know, it makes no sense. He's just not rational." And that's true if you only speak rationally, so to speak. But if you become bilingual and you begin to listen to emotion and the appeal of emotion, you begin to see there's an emotional logic. And I think it goes like this. I think that Donald Trump runs us through a four-moment anti-shaming ritual, and it goes like this. Moment one, Donald Trump says something transgressive, that Asian immigrants are eating your pet cats and dogs. Okay, it's outrageous. Or that immigrants are poisoning the blood of America. Okay. Moment two, the punditry shames Donald Trump. It says, "You can't say that. First of all, with the immigrants and the dogs, not true. It's a lie. And, you know, poison the blood. Well, look, we're all immigrants." So the punditry shames him. And then in moment three, Donald Trump becomes the victim of the punditry's shaming. He says, "Oh, do you know, look, they're beating up on me. You know how hard that is? They're making me look bad. It's terrible. It's painful. I am taking on this shame. I'm a victim. I'm holding it for you because what they really want to do is shame you. Haven't they already shamed you? So I will take that burden on." Moment four of Donald Trump's anti-shaming ritual is, "I will get revenge on the shamers. I will get revenge for you, against really everyone who isn't a MAGA
I
person."
mean,
But we're all in that category.
I was reading your analysis of that, and I found myself nodding my head. And then I had a question because there's that moment when, as you say, Trump says something which most people think is horrible or not true, that he gets called out on it. He says, "I'm a victim." And you note that, it's the punditry, it's the media, that's where he's those are the messengers to, you can't say that. And I wonder, does his victimization narrative change if it's an quote unquote average American, if it's somebody who, Bush, George H.W. Bush Republican, who says to him, "You can't say that about people. That is not acceptable." Or does he just end up demonizing whoever brings the message? It doesn't matter if it's media, a Harvard-educated attorney, a person who runs a grocery store, anybody who tells him what he doesn't want to hear is a demon.
You know, the barrel of the gun keeps moving. And at the moment it's on immigrants, but now it's moved to nefarious universities and, and public schools. And it's going to keep moving. He's saying, "Oh, immigrants aren't real Americans." But none of, people on the left, they're not real Americans. They hate America. So there is a growth of the category of villain, category of immigrant. But what I think is happening is that moment one and two, the Democratic side, the Berkeley side of America, is listening to that, the outrageous statement and the punditry shaming. But the Republican side of America is tuning in to moment three. Oh, they're beating up on him. He's shamed like we're shamed. And moment four, retribution. So to cross the bridge, between left and right, which is increasingly shaky as we polarize, we have to listen to the whole story and to ask why. Why is this catching on? One man told me, "Oh, Donald Trump, he's lightning in a jar." And I asked him, "I'm really here in Pike County to understand lightning." I think we all need to.
Yeah, and what was his answer? Here you are trying to understand lightning in the jar. What's appealing about it?
Well, it's interesting. The man who told me that And who is also told me that Donald Trump was sent by God, and he was the leader of the Eastern Kentucky Patriots. I'm a 35-mile long vehicle parade before the last election. That man is now actually having second thoughts. You know why? It's because he's interested in renewable energy. And it turns out a majority of Republicans are actually interested in renewable energy. Joe Biden allocated 80% of the Inflation Reduction Act money for renewables to red states. He's interested in doing something with that. And he's having a hard time reconciling Donald Trump's erasure of the very word climate change from government websites, having a hard time putting that together. So there are a lot of questions being asked now. It's a good time for us to begin to have conversations, respectful. You know, the Norwegians have a term of communities of difference. You know, you just don't agree on some very fundamental things. But you don't give up. You don't hang up your hat, and you have a meal together, and you begin some respectful conversations. And it's surprising what you can do. This man is now, you know, we're having conversations about what another candidate might do in this area of coal. It's a
Well,
coal
yeah, I
area.
mean, and I
And
think,
this is
yeah.
that hardcore. So, you know, I believe actually in the power of recognition. That how I think that's how Donald Trump has won them. And I think that's how we can win them back. Look, I hear you. A lot of us have gone through loss. A lot of us have, you know, been in a downward spiral and had drugs enter the scene. That's happened to a lot of us before. And it's a human thing, and there are better solutions. Those conversations are more available than we imagine.
Absolutely. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. Tonight, we've got the pleasure of speaking with sociologist and author Arlie Hochschild and talking about her new book, Stolen Pride. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you think people on the other side of the political spectrum from you deserve empathy, or have they forfeited it? You can give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Find us on socials or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. You know, Arlie, one thing I found fascinating about this particular region that you decided to focus on, as you said, the 5th Congressional District of Kentucky, which is the southeastern portion of the state. I mean, this is like the center of the Hatfield and McCoys, the famous, you know, conflict between two families. So these are people who, you know, historically, you know, you could even buy a keychain, as I read in your book, that celebrates this famous feud. And yet, it's actually got diversity in that community. I mean, you note that a lot of the doctors who work in the rural hospitals there have immigrated from outside of the United States, and Pakistani doctors, for example. I mean, there's certainly Black Americans who have lived there for generations.
Oops.
So, you know, so there's a texture. A racial and ethnic texture to this region that we on the West Coast might not realize exists in this district. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, you know, in some of the coal towns during World War I and World War II, there were some 35 different ethnic groups that where the coal countries had, companies had recruited them, and they were living, speaking different language, but also black and white together. And actually a lot of black and white cooperation in union organizing. And actually the word redneck comes from wearing a red kerchief. And if you did that, it was known that you weren't a strike breaker. Mm. Normally, they would bring in blacks to be strike breakers and to create conflict and to make the working class disunited. But the red kerchief, no, we're all wearing the red kerchief, and it went the other way. So it's paradox that redneck is used,
to represent a conservative when it was really a union supporter. You know,
that's right.
History is endlessly fascinating. I want to go to a listener comment who says, I watch Fox News so I can understand what people in this country, particularly the president, are thinking about. I think we need to acknowledge that Fox is its own propaganda instrument and that the news they report is not entirely based on facts. If that is all I watched or read, I too would hold some of these same views. And frankly, I do not think I am wiser or better for having consumed their product. This is a network focused on dividing us, making us mad, and making money. I mean, Arlie, there is some, part of what fuels the division and how many of us see where the country is headed, what's good, what's bad, what's not, is because of how we consume media and where we do get our news, which is more fractured than ever. Did you find in talking to, you interviewed so many people and got deep into their stories, that there was a commonality in how they consumed news?
Oh, yes. But they also would say, we're so divided and because we watch different programs. And they would say the same thing. Oh, if you watch CNN or MSNBC, yeah, of course, we would look like idiots. But here's the thing. And here's why getting together with people, arranging to do it and doing it is a good idea. There's a lot of work that looks at left and right. Do they understand each other? And here's some surprising findings. Each has erroneous stereotypes of the other. Okay, that's number one. But the left has more erroneous stereotypes of the right than the right does of the left. And why is that? Well, because we're more urban. We're in enclaves, highly educated kind of enclaves where we're with people like ourselves, not because we believe in it, because that's our jobs, our school take us there. And in more rural, semi-rural, blue-collar suburbs, where the right is concentrated, it's more diverse. And the next thing that is poignant and paradoxical, that polls show that liberal Democrats are more likely to break off a conversation with someone that says something they disagree with than are conservative Republicans.
Hmm.
And whites are more likely to do it than blacks. And so at the same time, another study found that what really lowers the temperature, a political temperature on a number of hot issues for the right, is face-to-face meetings. If they get to look at your face, you're a perfectly nice person, reminds them of their grandma, it changes things.
Hmm.
And that's more true for the right than the left, who are more used to mediated interactions. So
yeah, I think
it's a call for the left to get.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that that's an interesting point. And this listener has a little bit of a different view. They write, I feel like we spend a lot of time trying to understand the points of view of other people in this country. After Trump won in 2016, there were so many, quote, listening tours. I support trying to bridge the divide. At the same time, it's hard when I don't feel the other side is that much interested in hearing how I feel, how threatened I feel when people who are citizens are being detained and deported, how angry I feel that my daughter has left less rights than I had at her age. How crazy it makes me to think that this budget bill is gutting programs that would help all of us just to pay for tax breaks that help a chosen few. I would love it if people who voted for Trump had the same interest in listening to us as we do them. I mean, Arlie, it's kind of to your point that it's trying to bridge that gap of listening is going to take on both sides a little bit of tolerance and, as you say, just radical empathy.
Yeah. You know, I think I understand the young woman who gave this comment. I completely understand it. But it's too important to do nothing. It's too important. We have to. This is an emergency, and I think it's time for all of us to stand up and see what we can do. I mean, there are very good organizations that permit this. So I guess I think a lot of us may be cutting off conversations that could lead to some insights. You know, most of us are more moderate than the two parties. People are in the middle. More people are independents than are members of the Republican Party, the Democratic Party.
Does that...
And silence there.
Yeah, well, does that fact give Elon Musk some purchase to create a new independent party? Do you think that people who are neither left nor right and just want to find the middle will find some home there?
Oh, God. I hope not. I would like to see some repair. I would like to see the energy of Indivisible and many wonderful organizations enliven the Democratic Party.
Well, a truly honest answer there. I wanted to ask you about the fact that in this part of the country, the people who live there do not take kindly to the moniker of hillbilly, which I completely understand. And I wanted to ask in the context of J.D. Vance, whose very famous memoir was titled Hillbilly Elegy, which is, you know, this kind of juxtaposition of this word hillbilly with this word elegy, which is kind of a big SAT word, you know, idea. And, I mean, is J.D. Vance a product of a true product of Appalachia, and is he viewed as that kind of a natural heir to Trump by the people that you spoke to?
No.
Interesting.
Like him. Yeah, the very man I told you thought God had sent us Donald Trump. He said, "Oh, no, J.D. Vance is a drag on the ticket." you know what they feel? They feel like they're what matters almost as much as class is, are you a leaver or a stayer? Because a lot of people, you know, they love the hills. This is home. This is family. Strong feelings, but when war goes away, you've got to leave. Ironically, they're very much like the migrants. They are in our domestic system. They are the Mexico. They send, you know, the young and the educated out and receive back the injured and the elderly. So it's a paradox that they're being primed to take it out on migrants. They're migrants themselves. But they see J.D. Vance as someone who left for the city, made it big, and looks down on them. Oh. So it's not just the left they feel is looking down on them, but J.D. Vance too.
That is fascinating, given the way the left, you know, initially really embraced that book and the movie that came out of it and Mama and his whole story. Oh, that's so fascinating. J.D. Vance is neither liked on the right nor the left in certain circles. Another question I want to ask you about Kentucky is its governor is a Democrat, Andy Beshear, who had a very laudatory spread in, of all places, Vogue magazine recently. And I was looking at the counties in Kentucky that Beshear captured in his last reelection. And some of those counties were, in fact, in the 5th Congressional District, not Perry, Floyd, a few others. How is somebody like Andy Beshear perceived in the 5th Congressional District? And does his kind of Democratic politics offer a way forward?
I think it does. I was astonished that many of the deep Republicans I talked to would kind of lift their eyebrows, yeah, with some respect. Andy's done a good job. Yeah. And I think it all has to do, a lot has to do with his manner, which is highly respectful. And, you know, Team Kentucky, we can do it. We're spunky. We've been through hard times. He's sort of appeals to people's pride and strength. And he actually has brought a lot of new jobs to the area. And he's kind of the opposite, actually, of Trump. He doesn't start fights. He's a uniter. And after 4 years of Trump, I think he'd be the kind of guy that would appeal to people's desire to have good stuff happen again.
Somebody to put on our radar. Let's go to the phones. We've got Glenn on, Glenn from Marin with a question. Glenn, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you very much. Longtime listener, huge fan of the show. My question, Professor, I'm just curious, the people that you interviewed, how do they feel? What's your sense for how they feel about Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill? And in particular, won't some or many, perhaps even disproportionately so, be hurt by cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, or Pell grants? Thank you.
That's such a good question. Yeah.
Great question. Great question. And they haven't come yet. I would say they are confused and worried. Something like half of people in Kentucky 5 rely on Medicaid. And some people are, you know, working and still on it. And so the same, you know, with after school programs. And the main new source of employment in Pike County is a medical center. And that gets its money from Medicaid. So kind of the main source of employment would be severely hit. So rather than make America great again by bringing new jobs, it would be taking jobs away, not just services away, but jobs away. And people, there's a kind of silence about it. I went back and talked to them about that, about potential rising prices on the one hand due to tariffs and potential service cuts, which are already on the books. They haven't happened yet. And now with Epstein, I kind of believe in threes, that if you have three, you know, kind of challenges at once, that a paradigm can shift. But only if the Democrats have something united and positive to offer back, I believe.
That's a good point. Well, Arlie Hochschild, thank you so much for this book and your insights and helping us think more deeply about a part of the country that many of us probably don't know well. So great to have you.
Wonderful to have you, too. Thanks so much.
Arlie's new book is Stolen Pride, Loss, Shame, and the Rise of the Right. It's available now. It's an eye-opening read for anyone who wants to understand the emotional underpinnings of our political divides. Coming up after the break, we'll hear from State of the Bay's Ann Harper. She interviewed Tom Murphy about the celebrations in honor of Jerry Garcia this coming weekend. Time to bring out your tie-dye. We'll be right back.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and online at kalw.org.
With all that's going on in the world, we figured you could use a little break from the headlines. All this week on Bay Made, we'll share some local soundscapes of Bay Area creeks recorded by the Sound Geographies class at UC Berkeley. So tune in all week at 11:30 a.m. for some natural sounds, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ann Harper. This Friday, August 1st, would have been Jerry Garcia's 83rd birthday, and San Francisco will be honoring its native son with Jerry Day this Saturday at the Jerry Garcia Amphitheater in McLaren Park. It's a day of live music and celebration in the Excelsior District where Jerry Garcia grew up. Joining us tonight is Tom Murphy, Excelsior native and founder of Jerry Day. Tom, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
All right. So what inspired you to create Jerry Day?
Quite a bit, actually. You know, I lived in an area of town that didn't get a lot of attention. And when I went to high school, kids would ask me where I grew up, and I would tell them I grew up in Excelsior. And they said one of two things. They said, I don't know where that's at. Or they said, that's the neighborhood where Dan White grew up.
Do you want to explain who Dan White was?
Dan White was the representative of the Excelsior District at the time. And then in 1978, he shot and killed the mayor and one of the supervisors.
Harvey Milk.
Correct. So it left a dark cloud over our neighborhood for a long time. And that lasted a long time. Fast forward to 1995, I read an article that Joe Coffey, an advocate for McLaren Park out in Excelsior, was trying to rename the amphitheater Jerry Garcia because he grew up out there. When I read that, I was like, I didn't know this. How come nobody else knows this? So that stuck in my head for a while. And I started getting involved in community work, and there was an idea for a band show at a playground. And I actually raised my hand and I said, hey, why don't we put some of these famous artwork on this band show? And they said, that's a great idea. I'm like, who's the person? And then I said, Jerry Garcia. And they said, he didn't grow up here. I'm like, yes, he did. And they're all, well, contact his family and get back to us. And so I contacted the family. Mm-hmm. And long story short, that band shell idea never came to fruition. But we made a T-shirt to help fundraise for the playground. And it raised a few thousand dollars. And we had the first Jerry Garcia Excelsior celebration in 2002. And then shortly after that, we essentially moved the party to the amphitheater and called it Jerry Day for the first annual Jerry Day. That was in 2003. Then 2005, we renamed the amphitheater, the Jerry Garcia Amphitheater, on July 21st. We just had our 20th anniversary.
Right.
And now we're going on 23 years of Jerry Day, the 60th anniversary of the Grateful Dead. And this city is about to be awash with tie-dye from the Excelsior to the Richmond District and all over Golden Gate Park.
I want to get to the festivities in a minute, but first, what do you know about Jerry's childhood in the Excelsior? He had some tragedy growing up.
He did. He had two things happen. And at age four, he had his finger chopped off by his brother.
They were chopping wood or something.
Correct. They were out at the family cabin, I think, in the Santa Cruz Mountains. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, the dad drowned. I believe that was in the Santa Cruz Mountains as well. And it was tough on the family because they were running a bar, a business, down on First and Harrison. And, you know, after that, Jerry and his brother, they had to move in with the maternal grandparents' house. So he grew up on Amazon Street in Excelsior District till age five. And then he moved to his maternal grandparents' house on Harrington Street, also in Excelsior. That's where he learned to play guitar. And he actually grew up in a union household. His grandmother was a president of some union with longshoremen and merchant seamen and, you know, a lot of union people from the ports. And so he had a strong union background. growing up.
Nice. So what is on tap this year for Jerry Day? What's the lineup?
Well, for any Jerry fan out there, they're going to be in absolute heaven with this lineup. We got Stu Allen and Mars Hotel, and nobody does Jerry better than Stu Allen. And when people hear him for the first time, they flip out and they become an instant fan. And one of Jerry's best friends, Sandy Rothman, he told me, Tom, there's nobody in the country that can do what Stu does. And then in the middle of the day, we're going to have Melvin Sills, JGB. Melvin Sills played with Jerry Garcia for 15 years in the Jerry Garcia band. And Melvin lived right by the amphitheater. He absolutely loves the event. And his band brings it every single time. So he'll play a lot of Jerry Garcia tunes, the solo band. And, you know, you got to listen to Melvin Sills because it's a lot of Motown, rock, and soul. And then we just announced last Saturday that Peter Rowan will be opening up the show. And he's going to do a special acoustic set.
Fantastic. And I understand that there is a commemorative street signing celebration also this Friday. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. Jerry actually wrote a book called Harrington Street about his upbringing on Harrington Street. So the idea for this was like, okay, what about a commemoration plaque going there underneath Harrington Street? Harrington Street's only one block long. The family was very excited about that. So we think we're going to have a pretty healthy crowd out on Harrington and Mission this Friday at 11 a.m.
That's great. Now, will you see a lot of Jerry Garcia fans from outside the Bay Area coming in this weekend?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. We've got merch orders that went out to about 20 different states. People are asking me how to get to Harrington Street, how to get to the event, where should I stay at, you know, a good place to eat. I think the businesses around there are going to be thrilled by what's about to happen.
Why do you think his legacy still resonates so strongly?
You know, that's a very good question. And I think the way he carried himself as a person, also his talent. And at the end of the day, it's the music. The music is timeless. You know, I think Dennis McNally said it best. He was the publicist of the Grateful Dead for 20 plus years. And they were asking 2016, why is the scene growing? We have an intern working on Jerry Day, Gina. She's only 19. She took a class at Cal Berkeley about the Grateful Dead. And Dennis, I think he hit the nail on the head. People want to gravitate towards a happy space. And I think that's what's been happening. When people go to one of these shows, you know, they tend to forget everything else that's going on. And everybody's reflected in the moment about the joy and the energy that it brings. And I've converted a number of people to get in. I just tell them, hey, just check it out. And then slowly but surely, they get wrapped into it. Next thing you know, they're telling me lyrics from Ripple or Althea or want to get tickets to go see Dead & Company.
We'll have to leave it there. Jerry Day 2025 takes place this Saturday, August 2nd, at the Jerry Garcia Amphitheater in McLaren Park. Music kicks off at 11:30 a.m. Admission is free and the event is open to all. Plus, don't miss the Jerry Garcia commemorative street naming ceremony this Friday, August 1st at 11 a.m. on Harrington Street at Mission in the Excelsior. Tom, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and for all your work keeping Jerry Garcia's spirit alive here in San Francisco. So happy Jerry Day.
Happy Jerry Day, and thank you for having us.
I lit up from Reno, I was trailed by 20 hounds. Didn't get to sleep that night till the morning came around. Sit out, run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight. Ran into the devil, baby, lonely 20 bills. Spent the night in Utah in a cave up in the hills. Sit out and run, but I take my time. A friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just my guess.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Next week, join us when we'll be talking about the risks of heavy cannabis use. Does that have something to do with Grateful Dead weekend? I'm not sure. Remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We'd like your comments, your questions, and pitch us a story idea. We might produce it. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. It was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of KALW's new podcast in residence, Not Born Yesterday. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.